Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the foreign policy implications of a Republican sweep of Congress and speak with Jacob Heilbrun, a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, following a tweet by Ron Paul in response to Tuesday's Republican victories predicting, quote, more neocon wars in Syria and Iraq, boots on the ground coming soon. We will discuss the likelihood of a more hawkish stance towards Iraq, Syria, and Russia, sabotage of the pending deal with Iran, and whether Ron Paul's son Rand will challenge Hillary Clinton and America's foreign policy orthodoxy like his father is. Then we will speak about the failure of two-thirds of the electorate to show up to vote and the uninspired Democratic campaigns with Mike Lux, the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. We will discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Democrats Fail to Tell Their Story, and examine why the Democrats were unable to make a case against the Republicans for shutting down the government, creating gridlock, undermining economic recovery, cutting funds to combat Ebola, and not standing up for health care reform, while Republican governors with presidential ambitions pander to the haters on the far right by callously denying millions of Americans health care at no cost to their states. Then finally, we will look into how much Tuesday's Republican victories are a direct consequence of a strategy by the conservative majority on the Roberts Supreme Court to allow unlimited and unattributed campaign money in conjunction with enabling voter suppression. We will speak with Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts and author of Right Turn, The Decline of Democrats and the Future of American Politics, and discuss the likelihood that there will be a resumption of the George W. Bush economic policies of deregulation, tax cuts for the wealthy, and the gutting of Social Security to reduce the already shrinking deficit. Joining us now is Jacob Heilbrun, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the LA Times, a senior editor at The New Republic, and a Japan Society Fellow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Heilbrun.
Thank you, Ian.
And as I mentioned in the opening, Jacob, Ron Paul sent out a tweet in response to Tuesday's Republican victories predicting, quote, more neocon wars in Syria and Iraq, boots on the ground coming soon. At the very least, this would probably make life difficult for his son, Rand Paul, will it not? And it's certainly a challenge to Hillary Clinton and the American foreign policy orthodoxy.
I thought it was rather impish, provocative, and courageous of Ron Paul to send out that tweet. And he is making life a little ticklish for his son, calling him on the carpet in a sense, because I think that Rand Paul's sentiments are not all that far from his father's. I don't think he's an isolationist like his father, but he certainly doesn't want to see boots on the ground in the Middle East. And I think that this election could well turn out to be a big victory for neoconservative foreign policy.
So you think Ron Paul is right in predicting that this will be the swing, that the neocons will be empowered? And how will this take place? I mean, we know that they've got enormous traction in the Congress. I imagine the first manifestation of this would be to sabotage the Iranian deal, which is due by the 24th of this month.
That's correct. I think it would be difficult, if not impossible, for Obama to get a deal through Congress. He may try to bypass it. But it's important to consider the senators that are now joining the Republican majority. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton wrote his PhD dissertation on the political philosopher and neoconservative guru Leo Strauss. And Cotton has declared that the Iraq War, in which he served, was a noble and just war. And Joni Ernst, who is senator from Iowa, has went after her opponent for not wanting to further fund the Iraq War. So in my view, there has been a complete reversion is taking place in the Republican Party to the Bush-era doctrine of neoconservatism that held sway.
And Joni Ernst is a lieutenant colonel in the Iowa National Guard, I believe.
Correct. She will also trumpet an extremely truculent approach to American foreign policy. I'm not fully sure if American voters realize what's coming, because foreign policy only became an issue really in the final weeks of the campaign as the politics of fear took hold with Ebola, ISIS, and, of course, Russian aggression in Ukraine. All of these were skillfully evoked, if not manipulated, by the GOP to create the perception that Obama is utterly weak and feckless in dealing with America's enemies.
But, Jacob Harper, in terms of scuttling and sabotaging the Iran deal, already you have the Democratic sponsor in the Senate, Menendez of New Jersey. He's been leading the charge.
There's no difference between Menendez and John McCain on this issue.
And the president, in his press conference on Wednesday, in response to the drubbing that he and his party took, did mention that it's not entirely clear that the Iranian leadership is on board the deal, because the Ayatollahs, the supreme leader, is a professional anti-American, and the way that they hold on to power is by creating a war fever that allows suppression via the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Quds, and the Basij militia, and generally keep people in line by basically saying that we're at war with the Americans.
And we have Americans who say we're at war with the Iranians. There's a weird convergence of fanaticism on both sides.
Unquestionably. And I thought that if this Gordian knot is broken, a lot of foreign policy analysts think this could be one of the most promising foreign policy shifts in recent history.
There's no question. It's in the interests of both nations to have a detente. We have mutual enemies in the Middle East at this point. ISIS is a direct threat. Is more of a direct threat to Iran than it is to the United States.
But of course, we have the irony that Israel and Saudi Arabia are, for all intents, allies, along with Egypt, against the Muslim Brotherhood, and in general against any form of political Islam that's not either military governments or medieval monarchies.
True. I wonder, though, how much of the Israeli public is really opposed to a nuclear deal in the end if one were to come through. Practically speaking, I think it's politically useful for Prime Minister Netanyahu to be able to evoke the Iranian bogeyman. But in practice, I don't believe that he's confident that he would be able to terminate the Iranian nuclear program by launching bombing raids.
Again, I'm speaking with Jacob Harbron, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at The New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. So in terms of Russia, already Obama has a pretty hawkish, hard line against Putin. So what do you think the Republicans could do to make life more difficult for Putin and frustrate any possibilities of yet another reset?
Well, there's always a gap between reality and rhetoric. And on foreign policy, I suppose the Republicans have the advantage of not actually controlling the levers of power. So they can continually assail Obama as weak, no matter what he does. But it seems clear, doesn't it, that McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham and some others will be intent on the direct supply of military weapons to the Ukrainian army to create, I would see Nicaragua as a precedent, or other countries where we funnel in weapons and use a third party to fight Russia by proxy. Another thing would be to go full bore on a missile defense system which we have not done, but that Republicans have been clamoring for in Eastern Europe.
So I think all this is to indicate, I think, that in spite of the nice words coming from Mitch McConnell and from President Obama in Wednesday's press conference at the White House, I can't see any other thing happening except that the Republicans will continue their priority to obstruct and embarrass Barack Obama at every turn, and it'll just get worse, won't it, as the 2016 elections approach? Isn't that how they're going to diminish him and his party and his successor?
Absolutely. We ain't seen nothing yet, as the saying goes. Mitch McConnell has been machinating for 6 years to destroy the Obama presidency, and his plan actually has worked pretty well. It's finally reached fruition. What would be his incentive to abandon it at this point? I think the battle between the two sides will become much more ferocious.
So, in other words, he vowed that he'd make him a one-term president. That didn't work out in 2012, so he's going to make him, a one-and-a-half-term president?
That's a good way of putting it. He certainly made Obama suffer, and he pretty much has pinned him into a corner. I find it kind of astonishing, however, how little culpability Obama is willing to accept himself for this state of affairs. I don't know how you feel about it, but I thought that his complaint that it was the situation was the worst since Eisenhower, and he seems to me to be dodging and shifting blame and not accepting his own share of responsibility for this, because Obama's record and his statements have been pretty meager over the past years. I mean, I do not think he's done a very good job of defending himself.
Well, that was his peculiar and passive acceptance of the fact that Democrats around the country would run away from him as though he had Ebola. I mean, I remember, and I'm sure you do, Jacob Halbrin, the absolute folly of Al Gore not allowing the world's best campaigner, Bill Clinton, to campaign for him in the South, which he entirely lost, even though he did win the presidency, of course, in 2000. The first thing he did was to unnecessarily concede an election he'd won. So, I mean, that was bad enough. But this time around, I was astounded at the idiocy of these Democrats running away from him, particularly Alison Grimes in Kentucky, refusing to say that she'd voted for him. I mean, would anybody believe a person like that, who is so mealy-mouthed about something that meager, would be a person you'd want to vote for?
Yeah, there seems to be something embedded in the DNA of a lot of Democrats that they simply cower when they're put on the spot or when they're attacked. And the Republicans certainly conducted a much more skillful campaign than the Democrats in the past year. I mean, they really set the terms of the debate at a moment when the economy appears to be recovering. They successfully painted a portrait of not of a morning in America again, but of America going into the twilight under Obama.
Well, but again, they were helped by the fact that both the candidates running ran away from Obama, and Obama sort of passively accepted the idea that maybe they did have something to be, you know, either ashamed of or not want to talk about. And they both acted, frankly, like guilty children who don't want to own up that they've done something wrong.
Yeah, the origins of all of this may be Obamacare, don't you think? Because that was supposed to be Obama's great accomplishment, and instead of touting it after he's passed, he ran away from it, as did everyone else.
Right, right. And all that does is give credence to the Republican narrative that there's something wrong with it.
Yeah, it's quite amazing, because you have over 20 million people signed up. And in Kentucky, of course, it's turned out to be functioning very well.
No, that it truly is mind-boggling when you try and... But, of course, the one thing, and Obama did make a reference to this in the press conference on Wednesday, that two-thirds of the electorate didn't vote, and I imagine that most of them are Democrats. That is hardly an excuse, because, after all, you know, you guys, the Democrats, politicians, you fail to inspire these people.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. One of the problems is why didn't they vote? It's because a lot of people lost faith in President Obama, and he speaks, as you pointed out, in such a faltering and not rambling, but half-hearted way that you feel despondent when you listen to him in his press conferences.
So in terms of the foreign policy landscape ahead and how much the new Republican domination of the Senate and the House, and it's pretty substantial, particularly in the House, I guess the only area where there'll be any kind of foreign policy achievements are on these trade deals, particularly the TPP. And, of course, the Republicans are, this is perfectly in sync with their philosophy because it takes away sovereignty from governments and gives them to the free market.
But even there, you could have a rebellion from Rand Paul or Tea Party people who jealously want to preserve American sovereignty and don't believe in globalization. There could be a union of people in the left, the union side of the Democratic Party, and the very conservative, some conservative wing of the Republican Party. I don't think it'll be a shoo-in to get a free trade treaty through.
And that same coalition is all that's stopping the surveillance state, right? And so
Correct.
Far, and if I don't know whether you've seen this amazing film called Citizen Four about Edward Snowden, but you left after seeing this film thinking, my God, what did Snowden achieve? Virtually nothing. The surveillance state is back up and running.
Well, as someone pointed out, there will be almost no, it's not even clear that the CIA torture report in the Senate will be released. It's a big victory. Pat Roberts is a big booster of the national security state, and he won re-election. So it's going, doesn't augur well for those who believe in preservation of civil liberties.
But what's that to say, though, about this idea of a coalition between the Democratic left and the libertarians?
Come,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, not obviously there's no common ground on domestic issues because the libertarians, Rand Paul and company, want the Koch brothers to run America, and this election that just happened looks as though they are running America, for God's sake. So, but in terms of foreign policy, there's certainly some confluence there, isn't there?
Yes. It'll be, you know, how much influence they're able to exercise, whether the Republican Party itself is able to remain united over the next 2 years is also a big question mark. I mean, Ted Cruz has made it clear that he's contemptuous of Mitch McConnell. So, and you have several candidates that are going to be in the Senate that are aiming to run for the presidency. So before Democrats give up, I think it is questionable whether the Republicans will be able to act in unison or even effectively. The whole thing could just degenerate into chaos.
As the Rand Pauls and the Ted Cruzes run for president, obviously they're going to try and make their mark, you know.
Yes, and John Boehner does not. How much control does he have over the Tea Party faction? In a way, what this election has done is created an infusion of more radical conservatives into the party, and that, you know, unless they're able to assimilate them or come to some kind of accommodation, there could be a civil war inside the GOP itself.
And it could be that Tom Cotton and Joni Ernst are going to side with Ted Cruz. They're soulmates, aren't they?
Yes, certainly on foreign policy, without a doubt.
Well, Jacob Harbron, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jacob Harbron, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times, a senior editor at The New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the failure of two-thirds of the electorate to show up to vote and the uninspired Democratic campaigns.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't. Exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Lux, a partner in Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995 and is the author of The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Democrats Failed to Tell Their Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lux.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be on again.
And Mike, out here in California, it seems that we're heading in a different direction from the rest of the country. It's as though California is moving into the 21st century while the rest of the country is moving back to the 19th century in economic terms and the 17th century in social terms.
It does seem that way, doesn't it? And thank God for California. Thank God that it exists and that the trend is moving the right direction. There are other pockets of good things as well around the country. But yeah, it was a very tough election. The Democrats screwed this one up and played defense the whole cycle long, and we're paying a price for that.
But in playing defense, it was as though they had something to hide, and that as though they were guilty, almost like guilty school children. I recall when John Kerry was first attacked by those sleazy Swift boats, for whatever they were, the Swift boat people, who went after the best thing that he had going for him, which was his war record, which they slimed. And initially, yep. Kerry didn't want to even deign to respond to these sleazebags, but it left him looking guilty, as if he had actually had something to hide and apologize for. Yeah. And I saw the same thing happening in this cycle with the Democrats running away from Obamacare, particularly in Kentucky, for God's sake, where Obamacare is working better than it is anywhere else in the country.
Well, and ironically, you know, in Kentucky, the program has become so popular that Mitch McConnell was saying, well, I still want to repeal Obamacare, but we'll keep the Kentucky part, as if that was possible, or made any sense at all, you know, to anyone who knew anything about the legislation. So even McConnell was backing down on the issue, and we should have aggressively taken advantage of that. You know, I just think sometimes Democrats get into a defensive crouch, and part of it is that they don't necessarily believe or aren't excited about, you know, the good things that the party does. They sort of have to be dragged into doing the right thing on those occasions when they deign to do it, and so you've got this dynamic where, you know, they're feeling defensive about stuff. They're not willing to go to the mat for it. They're not willing to go on offense about it. But, you know, you don't win. I mean, I've been in politics a long time now. I've been in politics now full-time for almost 35 years. And there's one thing that I know about elections. You don't win when you're on defense. You just don't. It is impossible, unless you just are lucky or your opponent is completely brain dead. It is impossible to win, you know, being on defense. And that's what Democrats need to understand, so that when they've got these tough cycles, like the one we had today, you know, we had a bunch of red state swing races. We had Obama's popularity low. And instead of going into a defensive crouch, we should have developed an aggressive, populist, authoritative message and gone for it. That's the way you survive a down cycle, is you go on offense, and we failed to do that.
And what do you think the reason is, Mike? Is it because these candidates listen to pollsters and so-called professionals, or is it because they get their money largely from the same people the Republicans get their money from?
I think it's both. I think, you know, there is a wide swath of professional pollster consultant types who play that cautious game, who believe that the only way to win is by going to the middle and appealing to the middle and backing away from the Democratic agenda. To me, that is, you know, that is dumb politics, and it doesn't make any sense. I'll give you an example. Mark Pryor in Arkansas, He has the minimum wage on the ballot in Arkansas. The minimum wage, which is overwhelmingly popular, won by a huge margin, affects the exact swing voters that his campaign was trying to appeal to, lower wage white as well as black voters, appeals to his base, the Democratic base, who he was trying to turn out. But he got some advice, which he stupidly took, which was the minimum wage thing, that's like part of Obama's agenda. We don't want to do anything to embrace Obama's agenda. So he sort of tepidly endorsed it and never talked about it, even though it was on the ballot. You know, I mean, it was on the damn ballot. He could have made that a huge issue in that campaign. So you get that kind of advice, and it's brain dead thinking. And then on the other side, as you say, there's the money thing. One of the things that I said in this HuffPo piece today was, you know, when you're in this situation and you're playing defense, you have some choices that you have to make, and you know, you can aggressively take on a Democratic agenda, which is, by the way, 70, 75, 80% popular. That agenda includes raising the minimum wage. It includes expanding Social Security benefits. It includes expanding student loans and making them less costly. It includes a range of, I mean, it includes taking on Wall Street. It includes taking on big oil. Those things are popular in America. They're overwhelmingly popular in America. And a Democrat should be able to run proudly. What I said in the article is, if there's a D behind your name and you're in a red state, you need to explain to voters why you're a D. If you don't explain to voters why you're a D, they won't vote for you. I mean, their natural inclination in a lot of these states is to vote Republican. So you have to tell them, look, this is why I'm a Democrat. This is why I'm running this year as a Democrat. But that agenda I just laid out, it appeals to red state voters as well as blue state voters. It appeals to moderates. It appeals to the Democratic base. It's a winning message. It's been proven to be a winning message. The people who ran on that won, in some cases won easily. So to back away from that or to muddle it up or to be defensive is craziness.
And given that, as the president mentioned in his Wednesday's press conference, that two-thirds of the electorate didn't show up, what he didn't say is that they were, you know, they were uninspired by Democratic campaigns. And I'm curious to know why the Democrats were unable to make a case against the Republicans for shutting down the government, creating gridlock, undermining economic recovery, cutting funds to combat Ebola, and not standing up for health care reform, while Republican governors like the ones that just got elected, Rick Scott, Scott Walker, and Perry in Texas, these Republican governors with presidential ambitions who are pandering to the haters on the far right by callously denying millions of Americans health care at no cost to their states. So that's just some of what they could have run on.
It is, and it's what they should have run on. Look, like I said, you know, even in red states, there are plenty of Democratic issues that are widely popular. There's plenty of messages that work. What we did instead is we did basically a two-part message in a lot of these states. Which was one part defensive, and the other part was fine, but it wasn't enough. The part that was defensive was, I'm not Obama. There was ad after ad after ad with lines like, my name's not Obama, or my opponent's trying to tie me to Obama, or I don't support Obama on blah, 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 right? So that was part of the Democratic message in a lot of these states like Arkansas and Kentucky. And the other part of the message was, my opponent sucks, right? Which, by the way, you can't use the word sucks in a quote in the New York Times. I was quoted in I was interviewed for the New York Times today, and they wouldn't let me use the word sucks. So I guess their standards of journalism are really high. Just had to throw that out there. Anyway, And saying that the Republican is bad on a whole set of issues is great. I'm for it. And you want to attack, but it's not enough. You can't just tell why your opponent's bad. You can't just be defensive about the fact that you're not Barack Obama. What you have to do is you have to tell people why to vote for you. People don't win unless they're told that, and especially in red states, in tough states. People need to know why they should do something they don't normally do, which is vote for the Democrat. And the Democratic base needs to know why they should turn out in an off-year election where they don't care that much, they're not following that much, they don't think it's that important. They have to understand why they should turn out and vote. So anyway, I think what the Democrats did this year on the message in individual races was a crime. I would also add one other thing, Ian. I know I'm talking too much here, but I think that the Democrats needed to have a big mega message. They needed from the top, at the national level, they needed to have the Clintons and Pelosi and Reid and Obama and the groups that work with them all pushing out a broader narrative message about how the Koch brothers are trying to buy the elections, about how these are the terrible things the Republicans are going to do. They needed to have a message about what this election is about, but they didn't want to nationalize the election because there are all these red state races. The problem with not nationalizing the election is it's nationalized anyway. And so the Republicans controlled the narrative. The Republicans' narrative was Obama's incompetent. He's failing. He's beset in a world of trouble. And we had no counter message. And without a national narrative, without a big picture, broader narrative, we were in deep trouble. And so we stayed on the defensive this whole race.
And Mike Lux, this was a record-breaking midterm. $4 billion at least was spent, and fewer people vote. So that may well be the real indictment, that we're spending more and voting less, or less people are voting. What do you think, though, can be done to... I mean, my sense is that so many progressives that I know, and I know that you work, you're the CEO of Progressive Strategies, they are pretty faint-hearted and very disappointed in Obama. And a lot of them are talking about forming third parties, which perennially comes up. You know, the old joke is that we need a third party because then we'll have two. You know, so, but we also know that if you form a third party on the left, all you do is help the right. And conversely, you know, we know from Ross Perot that if you form a third party on the right, you'll help elect Clinton. So that's how the American system works. Why doesn't anybody think about, you know, the big tent in terms of the Democratic Party being, you know, if it's run by all these brain dead people who don't have any guts, who don't stand up for anything and don't appear to believe in anything, and take their money from the same people that the Republicans get their money from, why don't progressives take over the party like the Tea Party has taken over the Republican Party?
Well, we need to. I think that right now, I mean, the challenge of taking over the party is, in effect, there is no party. It's a loose amalgamation of a lot of different individual politicians, and party structure really doesn't mean much. It's very much identity politics. There's people who are excited about Obama. There's people who are excited about Clinton. And so I think it's very hard in that context, but I think progressives should be working in a variety of ways to dramatically strengthen their hand in the party. A lot of it, of course, has to do with money and politics. The reason that Wall Street has such huge sway in the Democratic Party is because they contribute so much of the money to the candidates. So you've got this problem where like we were talking about a minute ago, the Democrats are worried about too populist a message because they don't want to offend their big money benefactors. So you're caught in a tough place. I think progressives have to have a strategy where we drive forward on issues. We make certain villains so toxic that Democrats, you know, don't want to take money from them anymore. We do issue organizing campaigns to make it impossible for Democrats to ignore, and we run primaries against corporate Democrats who won't pay any attention. So I think it's a combination of strategy. I don't think there's a silver bullet, but I think there's a lot that progressives can do in the years to come to change things.
Well, Mark Lux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Happy to do it. I always enjoy conversations with you, Ian, whether on the radio or just hanging out.
Well, this is happening on a pretty dark day for a Democratic strategist, I have to say.
So. Well, it is, but you know what my attitude is. I've been through a lot of bad elections, and I've been through a lot of good elections. The thing is, the day after, you just have to keep fighting. You can never give up. You never stop fighting. And some of my greatest victories, some of my greatest joy in politics has been in the years immediately after a big electoral loss. And I could tell you plenty of stories about that. About in 1995, I helped organize the battle against Newt Gingrich on the school lunch program where we kicked his ass and stopped the contract with America dead in its tracks. In 2005, after a big Bush's big reelection victory, where they picked up a bunch of seats in the Senate and House, he took on Social Security privatization, and we absolutely kicked his ass, set him back, started him in spiraling down, and we ended up sweeping to victory in Congress in 2006. There are so many stories about how you can win, both on issues and elections, in the years after defeat. And that's what we have to keep focusing on. Never give up. Never stop fighting the good fight. And that's the attitude you have to take. So I'm energized today. I'm ready to keep fighting.
Well, Mark Lux, again, thank you. And Mark Lux is a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison at the White House from 1993 to 1995, and is the author of The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Democrats Fail to Tell Their Story. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the likelihood that there'll be a resumption of the George W. Bush economic policies of deregulation, tax cuts for the wealthy, and the gutting of Social Security to reduce the already shrinking deficit. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's a member of the advisory board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation, and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and Right Turn, The Decline of Democrats and the Future of American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
So, Tom, it seems to me that, you know, the president, by the way, in Wednesday's press conference alluded to the fact that two-thirds of the electorate didn't bother to vote. But, of course, it's his problem or his fault and the Democrats' fault for not inspiring them. But why did they run away? Because it seemed to me the heart of it was, particularly in Kentucky, where this ridiculous woman, Alison Grimes, wouldn't say that she'd voted for Obama and ran away from Obamacare in a state where Obamacare is working better than anywhere else in the nation. Was that their main problem, that they just ran away from their single most significant achievement?
I don't think that was their main problem. Their main problem was that all of those achievements don't add up to much for the average American, at least in the short run. And the, you know, the health care bill has many good things. It also has some really dreadful stuff, like its near complete lack of regulation of balance billing. And you can, and this is causing a lot of trouble for people. The average human does not see clearly that this is so wonderful, because it isn't. And, you know, that's, so let me just set the health care aside. I think that was on balance, a step forward, but it was not a giant step forward. And for a lot of people, it's just been nightmarish trying to find, you know, get, navigate these health sites. I mean, the and so forth. And but fundamentally, you know, the problem is very clear when you just about everybody's polls. The clearest one, I think, is the poll now up on CNN, which is an exit poll, which is basically just saying, look, everybody seemed to take the economy as, you know, the single largest issue they saw. And the Obama record on this is just not very good. After, you know, 6 years after he got elected, we should be doing better than we are. These guys have just failed to deliver. And so, you know, it, what can you say except if you sort of give you Republican light as your policies, you're likely, particularly given the highly skewed electorate, which is looking to me, I mean, I haven't seen any national estimate on this yet, but I did see one fairly solid estimate from Ohio, which suggests a truly disastrous turnout, maybe the lowest in decades for an off-year election in that state. And I suspect that that's likely representative of what you're going to find when we sort of add up all these numbers, which one trusts will happen fairly soon. You know, even abstracting from the weak turnout, there's not a lot of reason, I think, that most people who supported the president saw to come out and vote. He's disappointed nearly everybody. His own stewardship of just about everything in the last year has often, they seem always behind the curve, and often they seem like almost stumble bum in the way they sort of make decisions and get caught off guard. It's not an encouraging picture. And so, in effect, you've got a mediocre record and, frankly, close to Carterization, if you remember how Carter looked in the last 2 years of his term in the late 70s. It's not surprising that lots of people just got disgusted and didn't turn out, and that many more just voted the other way. I mean, you know, we are essentially at the moment seem to be locked into this cycle of in-out, out-in, in-out. Same sort of thing you saw in the Great Depression, the sort of, though then usually at about the third iteration of that, something different turned up. Possibly we're arriving at that spot. It is interesting to me that, you know, the Republican policies, as best as I can read them, are pretty much the economic policies of George W. Bush, which, along with a lot of help from Bill Clinton and others who deregulated finance on a colossal scale, gave you the 2008 crash. In that sense, I can guarantee you that just moving to cutting deficits, cutting taxes on the rich, and the other things that are in the Republican list of desired steps, that's not going to get anybody very far in this economy. And with, you know, the Chinese weak, Europe going down rather almost like a submarine at this point, and the Fed tapering off its, you know, own quantitative easing program, it's not clear to me that anybody has any convincing answers here that the policy folks in either major party will accept. And so this is a real impasse. I regard this as essentially a vote of no confidence in Obama. You know, we'd be better off, frankly, if he resigned and made Biden president. If he's not interested in the job, he seems almost uninterested these days. And in any case, here we are and we now have effectively the war of all against all. That is to say, all of the legislative branch, Congress, against all of the executive branch, democratically controlled. And, you know, welcome to the stalemate machine round, what is it now, five or six?
Right. I was listening last night to Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Democrat, pretty much in charge of their sort of fundraising and messaging in the House, you know, going on about how the Republicans shut down the government and created gridlock. And I thought to myself, well, how come you didn't make a case for that in the campaign? You've just said that how they haven't stepped up on the economy, but they have been frustrated at every turn by the Republicans, who have definitely held back economic recovery with their obsession with cutting the imaginary deficit, which is just a stalking horse for the tax cuts for the rich. We know that. But the point I want to make here, Tom, is that I'm beginning to wonder whether, in fact, since the Republicans created this gridlock, they've been spewing hatred, they've held back recovery, yet they were rewarded. It feels a bit like a political version of the Stockholm syndrome, where the electorate has identified with their torturer.
Well, except, you know, as we said, two-thirds of the population, I'll take the president's guesstimate there, is largely likely to be right, though I suspect it'll be a little high. As right, two-thirds of the electorate didn't bother to vote. And, you know, so what'd they win by last night? 55-45 on the nationwide vote total? I haven't seen a summary of that, even if it's 60-40. Though a lot of these, note that a lot of these elections were fairly close. I mean, the Republicans won North Carolina by about 2 or 2.5% of the electorate, at least on the stuff I saw. And they were, you know, narrow winners in some other places too. Do the math, 3/5 of 1/3, you know, where does that take us? To around 18 or 20% of the population? And that's the folks who voted for the Republicans. And in that sense, there aren't that many people identifying with anybody. And the other thing, striking thing is, you look at the polls of the exit polls, so these are folks who did vote, huge numbers of them are highly critical of both parties. And they're highly critical not just of the president, but of the Republican Party. In some cases that's coming from the right as well as the left, but this is not a sort of giant wave of sympathy for either the Republican Party or whatever you think it stands for, which at that point surely must be hugely discordant depending on where you live in the United States. So, I mean, my sense is what you have here is policy failure, which has led to a huge distancing by the rest of the population. And, you know, after they all spend, what, $4 billion or so, it's clearly a record cash expenditure on elections. We won't know how big for another 3 weeks or so until the final election of reports are filed. After all this, I'll just adopt as my 18% of the electorate knocks 12% of it out, and we get this, what we got. I mean, think of it as the triumph inside an hourglass or something like that. It's not, we're not looking here at a giant wave that has somehow become irrational. I don't disagree that the Republicans stirred up a lot of hate, you know, but it left most everybody cold in the end. It just didn't work as a mobilizing device. It got victory, but with a lot of help from the president. I do take your point about why they didn't defend, the president did not defend himself. I could not figure out, for example, after, who was it, McCain, I think, said, we need a czar in charge of the Ebola outbreak handling. Which eventually led to pressure, and the president did finally appoint somebody. Why, the response was, hey, you guys haven't confirmed a Surgeon General. You know, we've been trying to nominate him. You won't confirm him. We didn't get that type of response from the White House. I mean, they almost seem scared of their shadow in talking. And, you know, it's fine to say the Republicans were obsessed with the deficit. They were. So was a big chunk of the Democratic Party, including the president's own economic advisors at virtually all points in his term. And that's, you know, if you're going to have two parties and one of them is a Republican and the other one is Republican light, and then you set up a situation where voter turnout is as low as it's gotten, you can be sure that the folks will turn out, will vote for the real Republican Party and not the light version. I mean, that's pretty much, the long and the short of it.
Well, Tom Ferguson, you just pointed out that this is a record $4 billion election with these, in which the side that won, you know, got about 18% of the vote, and the side that lost maybe around 15%. So is this the dynamic for the future? More money pouring in, fewer people voting?
Well, now the presidential turnout in 2016 will for sure bring out a higher turnout. But I suspect, you know, just as 2012 was, you saw a very high voter turnout, extremely unusually high. It ran to 63% in 2008. In 2012, it dropped to about 60. I would not be surprised if it drops, you know, again. And for sure, they will spend more money in 2016 than they have, you know, in 2012, the presidential race to presidential race comparison there. Yeah, you can be absolutely sure that you are going to see nothing but a kind of Mississippi River of money running through American politics. And yeah, because, you know, the money freezes the parties into these stances that doesn't allow them to address the population's real problems. You know, it makes politicians who know better keep talking about cutting taxes for the rich, for trying to cut public investment at a point when you could borrow at 1% and, you know, build yourself roads, schools, and things that people actually need. And it blocks them from actually doing something to sort of make sure that people can actually find work. And do nothing about a young person's unemployment rate, which is simply astonishing.
Except get them hooked on onerous debt, student debt, and
yes.
I mean this is our first generation of millennials that are crippled with debt before they even get a job.
That's right, and that effectively what's happened there is that when you look at say college financing, which is where most of that debt comes in. It turns out that basically the federal government support's fallen off and the hole's been filled just telling everybody to go pay for it themselves.
Well, Tom, let me ask you, though, in terms of what you just said, do you think that Tuesday's Republican victories are a direct consequence of a strategy by the conservative majority on the Roberts Supreme Court to allow unlimited and unattributed campaign spending in conjunction with enabling voter suppression?
Well, I think the majority, that 5-4 majority, which strikes so often as it did in the 2000 election and many but not all of those decisions you mentioned, they don't foresee all the things that just happened. But for sure, I think in those decisions, they are thinking I certainly think that they know very well if they allow unlimited spending in a period which most of us don't have that much money and unions almost cease to exist in most of the economy, that then politics becomes the plaything of the 1%. Yeah, I certainly think they think that. And yes, I think the Supreme Court is not to reverse a famous axiom of American politics. They're not following the election returns. They're leading it.
And in terms of the consequence of overturning the preclearance of the 1965 Voting Rights Act?
That was disgraceful. I mean, the only thing you can say is, well, here we are. It's right back. You say back to the Gilded Age? Yeah, 1896 or so. Not a bad place to sort of start looking there.
And back to Jim Crow, too.
Yes, of course. Yes. No. On the voting rights decisions, the Supreme Court, on the money decisions, they have been simply disgraceful.
So, just in closing, then, Thomas Ferguson, what do you expect then? Because I don't think, in spite of what Mitch McConnell is saying about nice things and Obama saying nice things, it seems to me the Republicans have a vested interest in continuing gridlock and hatred and divisiveness. ahead of the 2016 election. I mean,
of course. No. And you will see many whole ranges of newspapers articles that will be playing up, you know, racial and ethnic differences and things like that. When in the, you know, yes, that's absolutely for sure. It's also helped along, I may add, by a lot of poll displays that sometimes neglect to give you the income breakdowns for who voted. I mean, and they give you, you know, they all put, and even when they put it, it's usually at the end of the display. Ahead of it, they prefer to do gender, race, and sometimes religion. No, your divide and rule is certainly what you do in a situation where you have a society as unequal as the United States has now become. You know, that's not going to stay stable, except if you can find ways to split, you know, the bottom, one is tempted to say the bottom 98% of the electorate, but, you know, I mean, the different strategies there. You could see last night when you look at the polls, the people in the lower income brackets who did vote voted overwhelmingly for the Democrats. And then that just dropped off pretty much straight with a bulge in the middle a bit, more against them, more against the Democrats. I mean, this is very clearly a situation where if people vote and they are low income, they vote against the Republicans. So, of course, the Republicans have figured this out.
The 47%, right?
Yes, well, yep. You know, you'll see plenty of that. You know, we are here. We are just beginning, for sure, a kind of ugly, squalid period. I keep recalling to everybody W.H. Auden's, you know, comment about the 30s as a low, dishonest decade. Doesn't have much on the 20-teens.
Well, Tom Ferguson, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kate. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's a member of the advisory board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, a contributing editor to The Nation, and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and Right Turn, The Decline of Democrats and the Future of American Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.